We are doing a special Sunday morning edition of Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Ted Rall. Ted Rall is a political cartoonist, opinion columnist, graphic novelist, and former radio show host. He has twice been awarded the Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award and was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. His cartoons now appear in more than 100 publications around the United States, including the Los Angeles Times, Tucson Weekly, Willamette Week, New York Star-Ledger, Village Voice, and the New York Times. He is also author of numerous books, including To Afghanistan and Back, a graphic travelogue, Generalissimo El Busho, Essays and Cartoons on the Bush Years, Silk Road to Ruin, Is Central Asia the New Middle East, The Anti-American Manifesto, and he is here to talk about his new book, The Book of Obama, From Hope and Change to the Age of Revolt. Ted, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
It's great to see you, Mike.
So start out, tell us, what was your motivation in writing the Book of Obama?
Well, 2 years ago, when I put out the Anti-American Manifesto, one of the reactions to the book, which calls for the overthrow of the U.S. government, was that, what about Barack Obama? You know, here's a guy who's obviously, according to many liberals, doing the best that he can, but facing obstruction by the Republicans. And that's really the problem. That was a counter-argument that I kept hearing. And I didn't see things that way. I saw Barack Obama as our Mikhail Gorbachev. Eric Alterman said that Obama's the most progressive, liberal, well-intentioned, intelligent president that this system is capable of allowing to come to power, in the same way that Mikhail Gorbachev was really about the best leader that the Soviet system was ever going to elevate. And the irony is that the Soviet people saw that because Gorbachev was an okay leader, but the system was still not working for them, that the system was the problem. And if starting in 2009 with the Tea Party on the right, and in 2011 with the Occupy Wall Street movement on the left, we see a phenomenon. Obama has been the unwitting midwife of a revolutionary change in American politics. For the first time since the late 60s, early 70s, Americans are heading back into the streets. We're no longer outsourcing our politics. We have a tendency here in the United States, almost unique to us, to look at politics as something that we do on Election Day. We go vote. We put these leaders in charge. We figure they'll do a good job, and we check back on them 2 or 4 years later, and we vote accordingly based on what we find or what we our impressions. In other countries, politics aren't like that at all. Politics happen every single day. They happen with your over coffee with your friends. You talk about politics over dinner with your family. And in the United States, because we don't hold people accountable, our leaders accountable, on a day-to-day, hour-to-hour basis, in the same way that they do in, say, Europe or in other countries, even in dictatorships, there's more accountability, ironically, because people can go into the streets. There can be demonstrations, as we've seen during the Arab Spring. There can be riots, revolutions, uprisings. But our leaders don't have to fear that. But Obama, by being the least bad leader that we've seen for a while, still bad, but the least bad, has exposed the nature of the system itself. Let's remember, the biggest problem in the United States today is, without a doubt, the economy and joblessness. You know, between 20 and 25 and 28, depending on how you count it, million people lost their jobs during the 2007 to 2009 fiscal meltdown. And these days, there is no discussion of trying to figure out how to put these people back to work. I mean, we're talking about anemic growth that's really effectively negative jobs growth. And what's fascinating, I think, to most people is that the political system doesn't even seriously engage the question as to how do we get 20 to 25 to 28 million people back to work. We think, well, you know, we'll slowly pull out of it over time. I mean, they're not talking about it. I mean, I'm not even saying that the solutions that Mitt Romney and Barack Obama are offering aren't enough. They're really not even seriously engaged in the discussion, and we end up talking about a lot of issues that are not as pressing and not as important. I mean, you know, everything hinges on economic and political stability. If we go the way of the Soviet Union in 1991, you know, who knows what's going to come next? It's going to be really ugly, and we're going to forget about gay marriage. You know, I mean, it's when cities are burning. So, you know, to me, the system was irredeemable from the start. Now it's unreformable, and so really the way I'm looking at Obama is he's a catalyst for change in the same way that Gorbachev was. He's trying to save the system by trying to manage it and keep it going the way it was. The only way he really could have saved the system would have been to radically revamp it. But he was never going to do that. That was not his intention.
So, and were you surprised at all by the complete lack of action by, let's say, the Democratic Party once he came into power? I mean, to do anything even remotely progressive?
I was surprised by the extent. You know, when Bill Clinton came in 1993, and with a very similar ideology, you know, Obama, people forget this, but during the primaries, you know, he was the conservative Democrat. John Edwards was the one to the left and slightly more to, and in the middle was Hillary Clinton. And then, you know, he was the conservative Democrat. He was a member of the Democratic Leadership Council, the Clintonian centrist triangulation Dick Morris outfit. So, you know, ideologically, I wasn't surprised at all, but I thought, you know, this will be Bill Clinton all over again. You know, the smart money in Washington said we're going to see a cabinet that looked with a lot of Clintonista retreads. But really, that didn't happen so much. I mean, I was shocked when Paul Krugman didn't get the nod for Treasury or a Fed. You know, he was the guy who was right about the housing bubble and, you know, all along and is widely respected instead. You know, we got Timothy Geithner and these Goldman Sachs hacks who were wrong about everything. Forget about, again, the ideology. It's just they were mistaken. There was not a single progressive appointed to a cabinet, senior cabinet level position in the Obama administration. Remember, we had Robert Reich in the first Clinton cabinet. He didn't last long. And Locked in the Cabinet is a book that everyone should read if they really want to know what happens to liberals in a Democratic administration. But I was surprised by the extent of the complete freeze out. I mean, liberals are the base of the Democratic Party in the same way that conservatives are the base of the Republican Party. And you expect any kind of intelligent administration of a political party to include every strain of its ideological backers in the way that it governs. But with Obama, that has not been the case. I mean, there's been a little bit of lip service to liberalism in some ways, but usually, as in gay marriage, after the people have already led the way. I mean, you know, if Obama had never said that came out in favor of gay marriage was going to be legalized anyway. He's following the people. You know, we needed a leader to push for progressive principles, because they were really the principles that were going to get us out of this economic disaster.
So I'm sure you've heard as well as I have that a lot of the of our so-called elected officials, our leaders, say that, well, they can't do anything unless there's, you know, a push from the people themselves, you know. So have you been surprised by the up until the Occupy movement, the complete lack of push from any of its citizenry?
You know, I'm always surprised at how long it takes. But I guess, you know, historically, historians are always surprised by how long it takes for people to get angry. You know, we're tolerant sheeple. We put up with a lot. And then finally, people just can't take it anymore, and they head out into the streets. I mean, even now, the reaction is not what you would expect in terms of scale. I mean, when you consider that you have the lowest labor participation rate in the workforce since the 1930s, which means, you know, the real unemployment rate is over 20%. When you have, you know, if they calculated it the way they did back in the 30s, the rate's very similar to the height of the Great Depression. The misery is everywhere. What's striking is that it's so hidden. You know, people, instead of lining up for bread and selling apples for a nickel on the street, you know, they're double and tripling and quadrupling up on their relatives' couches. It's all, you know, people are lending each other money that they know that they're never going to be able to repay. I mean, you know, we're spiraling down the toilet, and yet it's hidden. And people, I think what's happened is that people are internalizing their misery and their anger. You know, they're turning it against themselves. They think that it's their fault. You know, they lost their job. And the system and the media really play into this. They say, like, well, you know, you should, you know, this day and age, you have to learn, build your own website. You have to blog. You have to, you have to learn how to market yourself. You can't work for one company your entire life. You have to retrain. Well, really? You have to retrain with what money? You got laid off. You don't have any money to retrain, and your salary's been shrinking for 40 years, so you don't have any savings. It's not your fault. And someone needs to tell the people that it's the government's duty to try to provide the basic essentials of life to the citizenry, especially in a country as rich as this.
So has this always been part of our culture? Do you think it's been amped up in the last, you know, who knows, 10, 20 years in terms of conditioning us?
I think it's accelerating. The propaganda of the media has become so much more effective. In the same way that we're able to do direct marketing, you know, we know your computer knows that, you know, what kind of products to pitch you, right, based on your surfing habits. And the political propaganda machine is nearly as sophisticated as that. They're able to know exactly how to push our buttons in a way that that makes us look at, for instance, resort to xenophobia or to turn against each other rather than against the system itself. I mean, we have learned to expect nothing from our government. I mean, that we're told that every day. It's like, well, don't expect anything. You know, this isn't a nanny state. You're on your own. It's like, really? Okay, if I'm on my own, fine. Then I don't want to pay any taxes at all. And I don't want to pay, and I should be able to park my car wherever I want. I don't want to pay a meter. And if I want to drive as fast as I can, I don't want to pay any speeding tickets. If I'm on my own, I want the benefits of being on my own. But it seems to me that the system that we're living in now is a system in which I'm on my own when it comes to expecting anything from this vast government infrastructure that is raping us financially and in other ways. And it's but when it comes to it doesn't work. It only works one way, and it's the same thing in the workforce. You know, your employers want to hire people who are pre-trained. It wasn't like that 40 years ago. 40 years ago, you know, if a company had a job to fill and they couldn't find enough, you know, you hear this all the time. You know, we can't find the skilled workers. It's so many unemployed people, but we can't find people trained in tool and die to fill our positions. Really? So hire smart people and send them to school the way that employers have done for hundreds of years. And, you know, but now it's like, no, you have to work for free in an unpaid internship, and you have to go to school on your own dime and then pay massive, exorbitant student loan interest that will enslave you for the next 10 to 20 years. Everything's on our shoulders. We have to bag our own groceries, pump our own gas, pay our own education, pay for our own retraining, suck it up when we're unemployed and our unemployment benefits run out. It's all on our own. And you know, they've gone too far. They just have pushed us too far, and it's just over. And it's you know, the rebellion has begun. It's going to be in fits and starts, but there's no turning back now. They have just pushed it too far.
We are talking with Ted Rall. He is the author of the new book, The Book of Obama, From Hope and Change to the Age of Revolt. So, Ted, what do you see as potential solutions and or steps towards this revolt?
Well, you know, when I wrote the Anti-American Manifesto a couple of years ago, what I argued was that the system is going to collapse anyway of its own accord. And it would sure be better, as messy and dangerous and violent as a revolution will be. I can't say can be. It will be. It would be better to have a revolution and manage that change rather than just have a collapse happen. I mean, it would be nice to save the infrastructure that we have now. It would be better to not see stuff burn. But I think that we're still heading into a collapse mode. I mean, there is effectively no left in the United States. And I'm not saying that I'm a cartoonist. I'm prone to exaggeration. But what I mean is, yes, we have liberals. We have progressives. But they work in service to the Democratic Party. They're part of the system itself. We don't have a left, which is to say an engaged, organized force that is dedicated to radical political, economic, and social change that is interested in not bringing back the Glass-Steagall Act, not in these kind of reformist moves, but in actually changing, rethinking everything about the way we live as people and in our relationship with each other and with the world. There is no group like that in the United States. And so, you know, there's just a few random authors, and there's our collected thoughts, and you know, there's really enticing poll numbers, like the 2009 polls that showed incredible support for socialism and communism as economic systems in a country this conservative. It was surprising. But so I don't think that You know, as much as I do hope that there will be an organization that will form spontaneously, and I think it's possible that that will happen, I also don't think it's going to take decades to organize anymore. I think with the internet, everything is different. You know, the internet is a tool of oppression. It's also a tool of organization and resistance. Every technology cuts both ways. And so I think things just move a lot faster. You know, an organization could pop up overnight, and within a year we could be having a completely different conversation. But I think right now, if I have to put my money on it, we're just headed toward collapse. It's just things are just going to get worse and worse and worse and more dystopian all the time.
Well, at the same time that this infrastructure could be coming about, I mean, we're also looking at extremes on other sides, like let's say the Tea Party and the Republican Party, which appears to be completely co-opted by the Tea Party at this point. Are you worried about that?
Well, yeah, that's a big part of my concern. I mean, you know, in this country, the right is very well organized, and they are convinced that they're besieged by the left. I mean, they're living in a fantasy world. You know, I mean, I did a cartoon recently where I said, you know, I would vote for like the right wing caricature of Barack Obama as a socialist Kenyan born Alinsky worshiping, you know, radical. I like that guy, except that he doesn't exist. And it's what's disturbing is, you know, it's been pointed out that you're entitled to your opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. Well, I mean, you know, the ideology of this country as a quote unquote mainstream in its media and what is acceptable in mainstream political discourse has been moving. I'm 48 years old, has been moving to the right my entire life through Democratic and Republican regimes alike. You know, I mean, it's hard to imagine Barack Obama being considered far enough to the left for the Republican Party of 1960. He would have been considered a crazy right-wing lunatic. Just be able, you know, we go to war without asking Congress, all the time. You know, every time there's any kind of, you know, little entanglement like Syria, you know, I don't think, Eisenhower or even Richard Nixon would have countenanced the idea that it's okay for a president to sign off on the assassination of an American citizen on American soil with nothing more than the stroke of a presidential pen. And similarly, you know, Barry Goldwater, who was considered a wild-eyed right-wing lunatic who was going to blow up the world in 1964, today would be too far to the left for today's Democratic Party. I mean, that's how far the needle has moved over. And, you know, I mean, those people are, you know, they're a big concern to me. The Tea Party, you know, the basic idea of the Tea Party is somewhat noble. Let's go back to constitutional purity. Let's get the government out of our lives. But what's happened is it's been completely bought and purchased by the Koch brothers and other corporate interests. And what's happening is that these very naive political babies that joined the Tea Party are, you know, have basic, they're rubes and they're babes in the woods and they're wet behind the ears. Any other metaphor you want, they're being taken advantage of, and their instincts as quote unquote patriots are being directed into xenophobia, gay bashing, and all manner of hatred and contempt of anything that smacks of socialism or leftism, even though really the complaints that they have are really left wing complaints. You know, I mean, you're complaining about banksters gone wild. Well, listen, you know, that's some, you know, leftists are the natural enemies of bankers, not rightists.
So do you see any opening there for dialogue amongst people who are participating in the Tea Party? And
I do, actually. And, you know, I'm a member of my local Occupy movement in Long Island, where I live, in New York. And, you know, we often talk about this. I think that revolution, you know, that people who oppose the state should get together regardless of where they stand on the ideological spectrum and form alliances of convenience. And we can always, as Ahmed Shah Massoud, who organized the Afghan resistance against the Soviets in the 80s, famously said, you know, first we kill the Russians, next we kill each other. Let's get together. And, you know, there's a lot of people on the right who I think have a better understanding of the nature of the system than some liberals, who really still think that if they go out and support Barack Obama, that he's going to bust out and become a liberal progressive, you know, as a lame duck. I mean, everybody's forgetting what happens in a second term, which is the day he takes office, the new president is a lame duck and, you know, doesn't really, even if he wants to, get much done. Second terms are, I don't even know why presidents want second terms. They never do anything. They can't. So, I mean, no, you're not getting liberal Obama in, you know, next year if he wins. It's not going to happen. And so, you know, I think that like liberals don't need to understand that.
We are talking with Ted Rall. He is author of the new book, The Book of Obama, From Hope and Change to the Age of Revolt. And in addition to your many books, you have a great website where people can access a lot of your resources.
Yeah, it's rall.com, RALL.com.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time.
Thanks for having me.
I thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
It was awesome. And everyone should call in and like send in massive amounts of money.